Okay, comrades. Well, what most people know about the Second Socialist International, if they know anything at all, really, is that it ended badly. Its major parties, other than the Russians and a few smaller outfits, betrayed the socialist cause by supporting their ruling classes during the First World War and sending workers off to be slaughtered in the trenches. And it's important to draw out the lessons of why the Socialist International went wrong, the fact that it had abandoned the working class and crossed over to the side of the bourgeoisie. However, that is only one reason to study its history, because there are also positive accomplishments in the early years of the International. Its formation was undoubtedly a step forward compared to the pre-existing scattered socialist movement, and for a whole period it played a progressive role. It enabled socialism to become a genuine mass movement. It developed a whole series of revolutionary leaders, including Lenin, Trotsky, Luxembourg, Zetkin, the list goes on and on. The Bolsheviks were trained within it, and it educated at least a couple of generations of workers in the basics of Marxism. And this was reflected in the fact that when the new revolutionary communist parties were formed in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution, the great masses of workers who joined them had been trained in the Second International parties. As well, there was nothing inevitable or axiomatic about the Second International's abject degeneration. Take the case of the International's most prominent party, the German Social Democratic Party, the SPD. The SPD's working class membership, concentrated in the key industrial cities of Germany, were in no sense wedded to reformism. In the key debates in the International, the instinctive response of the working class leaders in these centers was to line up behind the militant left, and by and large, they carried the rank and file of their branches, their districts, and so on. One example of this is in the important German industrial city of Dusseldorf, where the SPD's membership was overwhelmingly working class. When I talk about overwhelmingly working class, we put 99.9% recurring. The local party backed the left against Eduard Bernstein's reformist revisionism. It opposed alliances with smaller liberals, supported the mass strike tactic, had little faith in the central trade union bureaucracy, and by 1913, Dusseldorf's working class leaders were increasingly critical of the SPD's approach of seeking petty reforms or waiting passively for revolution to supposedly happen. And they wrote that this approach cannot possibly inspire and sweep along the masses. Only great goals can awaken enthusiasm and a willingness to sacrifice. Only a revolutionary tactic, which always builds on the reality of class conflict and appeals to the elementary power of the masses, can waken the energy, activism, and enthusiasm of the exploited proletariat. And I went on to declare, throughout the International, reformism and bureaucratization are widespread, and there is an effort to suffocate all revolutionary strivings. Sometimes it seems like the entire movement is gradually being bogged down while the bourgeoisie feels itself strengthened. The Dusseldorf SPD stood firmly against the war, and when the split came in the SPD, the vast majority of the local leaders and the members joined the Independent Social Democratic Party, the USPD. They enthusiastically backed the Russian Revolution and seized power and formed the workers' militia and took over their city in the course of the 1918 German Revolution. Okay, well, the Socialist International was formed in 1889, bringing together the loosely defined Marxist wing of the socialist movement as counterposed to various anarchist and reformist currents. By the time Frederick Engels, who played a preeminent role in the early years of the movement, had died in 1896, parties modelled on the German SPD had formed in a whole series of countries. And in Switzerland, A small group of Russian exiles had formed the Emancipation of Labor Group that laid the foundation for the Russian Bolshevik Party. Now, the Second International built on the legacy of the First International, the International Working Men's Association. The First International was a very broad organization involving British trade union leaders, Bakunin-style anarchists, Proudhonists, Blanquist insurrectionists, and of course, the small group around Marx and Engels. It was ideologically primitive, and Marx proceeded cautiously in his fight to move it towards revolutionary socialist conclusions and program. And the Marxists, in the course of the First International, won a series of debates and helped establish the idea that socialism was about the self-emancipation of the working class and could not be brought about and delivered to workers by, saviors from on high. However, the weakness of the First International was reflected in the fact that it disintegrated after the defeat of the 1871 Paris Commune in the context of bitter fights with anarchists and the sharp move to the right of the British trade union leaders. Despite this setback, within a few years, a mass socialist party had been established in Germany. In 1875, Marx's German supporters united with the rival socialists, Lassallians. And Marx and Engels at the time were very critical of the program adopted at the Unity Conference in Gotha. But nonetheless, unity proved to be a step forward. A more conservative competitor, the Lassallians, was killed off. That was an advance. And the space was cleared for Marxism to gradually become the dominant ideological trend within the SPD. And for some years prior to 1889, there were arguments then for the founding of a new international. Marx and Engels were initially cautious about this, given their experience of dealing with the anarchists in the First International. And in the 1880s and 90s in Europe, the anarchists were quite prominent, carrying out campaigns of bombings and assassinations. This is what they call the propaganda of the deed. In the early years of the international, the new international, there were major fights with the anarchists who played a continuing disruptive and sectarian role. And it was not until 1896 that the anarchists were finally expelled from the international. And that was an important step forward. Then there was the issue of the rivalry within the French socialists. In 1889, two international congresses were called in Paris. One, so-called Marxists, the other essentially reformists. The so-called Marxist Congress was larger, but chaotic in the face of ongoing anarchist disruption and did not decide all that much. The main advance in 1889 was that the Congress had happened. The flag was planted. And at the end of it, a series of resolutions were rushed through, calling for an 8-hour working day, opposing war, and calling for popular militias to replace the permanent armies. And what was become an ongoing controversial issue for protests and strikes on May Day. And whether to strike on May Day become a defining battleground in the international between left and right. Now, to get a real feel for the international, we need to look in some detail at the history of the German SPD, which, it was easily the most strongest party, and which had by 1914 over 1 million dues-paying members, overwhelmingly working class in composition. And it was estimated, and there's various estimates, but at least 80 to 95% of members were manual workers, drawn overwhelmingly from the skilled trades. And early on, from traditional skilled trades, bakers, the older trades, not so much the modern skilled trades. We also need to look at the political evolution of Karl Kautsky, who emerged as the international's key theoretician, known in the pre-war years as the Pope of Marxism. At the time of the 1875 Gotha Unity Congress, the supposedly Marxist group, headed by an impressive working-class leader, a carpenter, August Bebel, was quite eclectic politically. And Frederick Engels played a key role in educating the party, especially in his 1878 book, Anti-During. And Engels had a significant impact on the young Karl Kautsky and on Edward Bernstein, who was then very much on the left of the party. In 1878, antisocialist laws were introduced, and they were in force until 1890, and they were an attempt to break the SPD's rising influence. But support for the party actually increased, and it sharply moved to the left. In 1881, Kautsky argued that capitalism was in a profound crisis and there was no way out for the system. Revolution was near at hand, he believed. The bourgeois state, Kautsky argued, needed to be smashed by a workers' revolution that necessarily would be violent. He explicitly said it would be a violent revolution, and a democratic workers' state needs to be established. The working class would make the revolution, but to lead it to victory, a socialist party was necessary to organize the class-conscious minority of workers. So he's explicitly arguing at that point for a vanguard party. But with the lifting of the anti-socialist laws, there was a change in emphasis. In 1891, the SPD adopted a new program, the Erfurt Program, which became the model for the whole international. Kautsky's book, elaborating the Erfurt Program, was seen as the most authoritative outlining of the principles of the socialist movement. And in Russia, it had a massive circulation. Lenin declared in 1899, "We're not the least afraid to say that we want to imitate the Erfurt Program." The Polish Party, of which Rosa Luxemburg was a leader, modeled its program on the Erfurt Program. And the Erfurt Program, has to be said, was much more forthrightly Marxist than the Goffer Program. And it was a million miles. We've got to be clear. This is a million miles to the left of anything that the likes of the Jeremy Corbyns or any of these people talk about today. You know, a million miles to the left of them. Kautsky, of course, is subsequently often criticized for having a mechanical view of social development, seeing the caps of capitalism leading automatically to socialism. But this is an oversimplification of his views at the time. They evolved. Kautsky did, at this stage, talk about socialism being inevitable, but he also emphasized that revolution demanded human action. He wrote, "We do not mean that the social revolution will be accomplished of itself, that the irresistible course of evolution will do the work. Never yet was any revolution accomplished without vigorous action on the part of those who suffered most under the existing conditions. Patiently to yield to what seems unavoidable is not to allow the social revolution to take its course, but to bring it to a standstill." A clear call for mass action. The Erfurt Program called for building a party to lend this workers' class struggle a conscious and united character and to point it towards its necessary goal. Again, so the Erfurt Program is still calling for a vanguard party. But while it talked of social revolution, it fudged the question of how exactly socialism was to be achieved. It did not talk about smashing the bourgeois state. It did not talk about insurrection. So at the beginning of the 1880s, Kautsky had seen Parliament only as a tribune for agitation and not as a means to achieve a proletarian state. Now, the conquest of a parliamentary majority became the content of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and Parliament the necessary instrument for the exercise of the power of social democracy. Given the highly constricted democracy of Germany in these pre-war years, the issue could be fudged for a continued period because there was no prospect of the SPD forming a government out of elections. And economic expansion and rising working class living standards meant the revolution was not on the immediate agenda. So, on the one hand, the party maintained its commitment to an ill-defined social revolution. The SPD's policy was, in practice, very left-wing, one of a principal opposition to the Prussian state, No participation in bourgeois governments, no voting for budgets, no consorting with liberals. Nonetheless, reformist currents emerge within it, especially with the growth of the trade unions. Right-wingers headed by George Vollmer, who voted for the Bavarian state budget from 1894 onwards, were repeatedly condemned at SPD congresses, but not expelled. The revisionist debate with Bernstein, which exploded at the end of the 1890s, was symptomatic of developments. Bernstein argued for the abandonment of the goal of socialist revolution and turning the SPD into a liberal reform party. The left, headed by Parvus and Luxembourg, furiously attacked Bernstein. And Kautsky and Babel also had little sympathy for Bernstein's ideas. They commented to themselves that if Engels had still been alive, he would not have tolerated Bernstein. But they did not have Engels' revolutionary ruthlessness. Fearing a split, they contented themselves with motions at party congresses, overwhelmingly condemning revisionism, but took no practical measures against the reformists. A pattern was being established of centrist equivocation. The next test came with the 1905 Russian Revolution and the debate over the mass strike. The revolution in Russia radicalized the SPD and the Whole International. Kautsky moved sharply to the left for a period. He backed the barricade fighting in Moscow and argued that barricade fighting would be on the agenda in Germany at some point. And workers rallied to the mass strike idea championed by the SPD left. And Kautsky and Babel also prepared to countenance a mass strike. The union leaders reacted with horror. The 1905 SPD Congress overwhelmingly then endorsed a compromise motion moved by Babel for the use of mass strike for specific purposes, but not for its use as a challenge for power. This compromise was far from placating the union leaders, and they staged a revolt to kill off the idea of a general strike. And in short shrift, by February 1906, the party had capitulated. Party leaders were now allowed by the union leaders to voice platitudes about revolution and all good things nice and, cheese is green and the sky is blue. But union leaders now had veto rights over any active policy. Now, let's be clear. Kautsky had no sympathy for the union leaders. He scorned them. He despised them. He wrote that they were a rotten, narrow-minded reformist crew. But he and Babel would not stand up to them for fear of blowing up the party. Centrist capitulation to the SPD right had become an established pattern. And over subsequent years, the centre itself moved to the right. And this pattern of the ascender accommodating to open reformists was played out across the debates of the international, over the colonial question, over attitudes to war, over taking positions in bourgeois governments, on and on it went. But the rot was not fully exposed until the outbreak of the First World War. I should say a few things about the French socialist movement. At times, it could appear much more radical than the German SPD, with much more talk of insurrection and strident calls for action against wars and general strikes and whatever. But it was weakened by its commitment, by and large, to French nationalism, and like the SPD, capitulated at the outbreak of the war. When the French left revived after the defeat of the 1871 Paris Commune, it divided into a series of parties. Outside the parties, there was also a strong syndicalist current, which dominated the main trade union federation, the CGT, the General Confederation of Labour. Marx had helped to write the program of the Workers' Party of France, founded in 1879 by Jules Gassard. Then in 1881, there was a split from the Gassardists by the Possibilists, who were sort of a semi-anarchists but reformists. Then as well, there was the Revolutionary Socialist Party, headed by Édouard Vallant, an old blanquist insurrectionist. They united with the Gaissardists in 1902. But as well as them, there was a series of independent socialists elected to the parliament. Now, Engels sharply opposed any alliance with the independent socialists, headed by Jean Jaurès, a radical but no revolutionary. But Vallant backed unification, and Jaurès became the leader of the new unified party, the SFIO, the French section of the Socialist International, which was founded in 1905. Jaurès's faction gradually adapted to parliamentarianism, and he also joined the government at the outbreak of war. As well as them, there was also, in the years before the war, an ultra-left faction headed by Gustave Herve. He called for insurrection, general strikes, and so on, but he also became a minister with the outbreak of war. And the syndicalist CGT also backed the war. So the Second International, looked to by workers as a force to stop war, had failed miserably. Despite the radical sentiment amongst worker members of the parties, the revolutionary left inside them was not in a strong position to fight the reformist drift in the decade or two before the war. This was in part due to their own ideological confusion. It's often said that the revolutionaries should have organized a faction and at some split away from the reformists and centrists before the war. But to build a serious opposition in 1900 or 1908, you need to have a clear understanding of the issues at stake, be confident in your own ideas, and have a positive alternative road forward. To launch an all-out fight without a practical alternative perspective usually meant you were in a hiding to nothing, unless you were a Marx or an Engels with a proven track record. When he sensed things were wrong, for example, Engels was prepared to use his immense authorities, his standing authority, to intervene with hammer blows to absolutely pulverize his opponents like Düring. But after Engels died in 1896, nobody in the International had anything like his authority to take on the likes of Babel and Kautsky. The Lenins and the Luxembourgs were only just establishing themselves. A range of socialists were prepared to stand up to the reformists like Bernstein and Co., or to fight around specific issues like the mass strike debate, the May Day strikes, and so on. And these specific fights were important. From the lessons of those battles, lessons were learned, greater clarity was eventually achieved. Nevertheless, the reality was that prior to the war, not many people, and not just in the German people, SPD, actually they were to the left of both Trotsky and Lenin. None of them really understood how bad the situation was in the International, let alone had an alternative revolutionary perspective. Take the issue of the Erfurt program, which, as I said, fudged the question of the need to smash the capitalist state and establish a worker state, something Marx had been clear on in his writings on the Paris Commune. And as way back as the 1848 revolutions, Marx had called for the smashing of the bourgeois state. Yet, revolutionaries like Lenin and Luxembourg endorsed the Erfurt program. The lessons of the 1871 were largely lost, even on the revolutionary left, until Lenin wrote State and Revolution in 1917. Lenin was able to build the Bolshevik Party in Russia without being clear on these issues. Essentially, he agreed with the parliamentary road in Germany, but that wasn't on the cards in Russia. Lenin could muddle through because he was a committed revolutionary, determined to take the struggle all the way, and there was no genuine parliament in Russia. But to build a strong revolutionary opposition in the West, clarity on the role of parliament and smashing the state was necessary. Various anarchists and ultra-lefts did rail against parliament and loudly call for insurrection. But they had no workable program for building a mass revolutionary working class movement. Then there were the questions of mass reformism and the union bureaucracy. There were no revolutionary crises in Western Europe in the decade or two before the war. And this was the fertile soil for the emergence of reformist currents, both amongst intellectuals and amongst the growing union bureaucracy. And in this period, the SPD had considerable success in elections, in building the trade unions, and an orientation to parliament became entrenched. So a mass party was inevitably going to be subjected to enormous pressures towards incorporation within the system and the development of a conservative party apparatus. This was new terrain. Revolutionaries had no previous experience of confronting mass reformism on this scale, or an entrenched trade union bureaucracy. In some countries, syndicalist opposition emerged in response to the failures of the trade unions and the party leaders. In a number of ways, they represented a healthy response, a healthy attitude to the reality of where things were going. But on the other hand, it was abundantly clear, and it's been proved since, that trade unions were not going to be able to, however so-called revolutionary, going to be able to overthrow capitalism. And in any case, various of the syndicalist trade unions themselves succumbed to the reformist pressures, as much in many ways as the socialist parties. The Bolsheviks did not face these problems anywhere near as acutely as in the West. Under Tsarism, there was little space for parliamentary reformism or the consolidation of a trade union movement, let alone, an entrenched trade union bureaucracy. And until the war, it is very clear Lenin didn't appreciate the extent of the problem in the West. Then there's the question of centrism, the political current that vacillated between the left and right in the socialist movement. In the pre-war years, the left overwhelmingly concentrated its fire on the right. There was little recognition of the role of the developing centrist forces, let alone understanding that they were a serious enemy that needed to be fought. Like many others, Lenin and Trotsky were largely uncritical of Kautsky until very late. Indeed, in some of the debates in the International, they backed Kautsky against Luxembourg and his supporters. Luxembourg was the clearest, but it was only in the aftermath of the 1913 Jena Congress that she called for, quote, "a systematic offensive against the swamp by the centrists." Next, there was the importance of organizational questions. The SPD left made a series of mistakes on organizational issues which weakened their position. The reformists were considerably overrepresented at party congresses as the delegate ratio heavily favored rural areas and smaller towns, which were more conservative over the left strongholds. The left pretty much dominated all the major industrial cities. Even when the left actually gained control of the SPD executive on the back of the shift to the left at the time of the 1905 Russian Revolution, they did not then use their numbers to thoroughly change the party rules. The left's response to Bernstein is symptomatic of their weakness of this approach. They thought it was sufficient to ideologically defeat the revisionists and maintain Marxist ideological orthodoxy in the party. The left denounced Bernstein more vociferously than Kautsky and Babel, but they did not fight to cut the cancer out. They were not prepared to carry through the political fight to its organizational conclusions. And it was not simply the German left. The Bolsheviks never demanded the expulsion of the revisionists from the International. On its own, of course, a determined fight to expel Bernstein and his supporters would not have resolved all the problems in the SPD. However, his expulsion would have created a new terrain and shift the balance of forces in favor of the left in the party. And whatever the outcome, it would have helped to clarify the issues, prepared the ground for future battles, exposed the role of the center, and tested out who were the genuinely revolutionary elements in the party. It is often said that the failure to organizationally break with Bernstein reflected the fact that Marxists, including Marx and Engels themselves, were committed to an all-inclusive party. But this supposedly only changed with the successful Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Undoubtedly, the Bolshevik success was pivotal in establishing a new approach. However, Marx and Engels were not unity mongers. They drew up a clear-cut revolutionary program for the French Workers' Party and opposed unity with the reformers. They argued for the removal of a series of reformist intellectuals from the SPD. Engels backed the Socialist League in Britain in its split from the Social Democratic Federation. And they drove out the anarchists from the First International. The list goes on and on. You know, they weren't not nice, friendly, cuddly people. And talk of a vanguard party was far from foreign to the Second International. The problem was that the long years of relative capitalist expansion had helped prepare the ground for the growth of centrist and reformist forces that fudged the issues. The revolutionaries were not politically clear enough and not as authoritative and as ruthlessly determined as the like of Engels successfully take on the revisionists. It took the war, the capitulation of the reformists and centrists, and the wave of revolutionary struggle for the new layer of revolutionary leaders to begin to clarify the issues and establish a new tradition. Okay, to wind up. Lenin declared in April 1919, the First International laid the foundation of the proletarian international struggle for socialism. The Second International marked a period in which the soil was prepared for the broad mass spread of the movement in a number of countries. The Third International has gathered the fruits of the work of the Second International, discarded its opportunist social chauvinist, bourgeois, and petty bourgeois dross, and has begun to implement the dictatorship of the proletariat. For Marxists today, the lessons of the Second International remain very important as we attempt to reconstruct genuinely revolutionary forces after a long period of political retreat by the working class movement and even more so by the left. As the left revives, new left reformists and centrist currents are bound to proliferate. It is vital to have a clear understanding of their role and how best to fight them. Fighting to win a revolutionary socialist politics amongst the new emerging currents amongst workers and students attracted to radical sounding opportunists will be a vital task. And in that sense, looking back to the lessons of the past, while they're not exactly applicable to the next decade, are very valuable. And I'll leave it there.